Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 3rd, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is the presenter, Tom Kennedy. Today's session number is 98-1, and it is titled Remembering and Rethinking John Howard Yoder, Christ Against Culture.
So this is the first session of a series. Each of the sessions, I hope, are self-contained enough so that they'll stand alone, but I also hope there'll be some coherence so that if you come to more than one session, it will fit. My name is Tom Kennedy. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach philosophy at Valparaiso University. The general series title is This, Remembering and Rethinking John Howard Yoder. And tonight's session, as you can see on the board, or perhaps as you can't see, I'm not sure how the lighting is, but what it says there is Christ Against Culture, John Howard Yoder's Call to Radicalism. I wanted to start off a little bit with introduction to John Howard Yoder, and a good place to start is with how many of you are familiar, have read some of Yoder's writing, or have met Yoder, or heard him speak here at Holden or elsewhere. Just a show of hands of people familiar in some way with Yoder's work.
Is he associated with the Christian Century?
I don't know that. I mean, it'd be surprising if he never had anything published in there, but he tended to publish in very obscure places, and so that's probably not quite obscure enough to for his sort of publication. That's one of the interesting things about him, the obscure places he chose to publish. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Yoder, then, for those who aren't familiar with him, and remind those of us who are familiar with him. He, as I think Mark Schwain mentioned earlier today, he is or was a friend of Holden Village. He visited here at least four times, taught sessions at least four times. Many of the tapes are available in the tape library. He was here in 78, again in 81, again in 83, and 88. In addition to the tapes in the library, there's a copy of the first edition of his Politics of Jesus in the bookstore. It's available in a second edition, which costs more money than the first edition, and is not available in the bookstore. But the changes in the second edition are not such that that you would be harmed by buying a first edition. So I encourage you to go to the bookstore and purchase the first edition. It's still good. It's not quite as attractive a cover, I think, as the second edition, but the price is right, I'm sure. Yoder was born December 29th, 1927, and died quite unexpectedly this past December 30th, one day after his 70th birthday. I want to read a few words as way of introduction from Stanley Hauerwas's commemoration of Yoder. Hauerwas was you may know Stanley Hauerwas's work. He's a very prominent contemporary Christian ethicist who teaches at Duke University. He was a colleague of Yoder's at Notre Dame and underwent a type of conversion under Yoder's influence. Though, it, as Stanley mentions, it's a sort of conversion that John Yoder was not necessarily happy with Stanley being the... You'd have to know Stanley Hauerwas really to grasp what all that's about. But here are some words that Stanley wrote. The 1978 Festival Quarterly featured a profile of John Howard Yoder. The interviewer asked John if he enjoyed his significance. So this is 1978. Yoder had published in 72 The Politics of Jesus, a very influential and important book. And so in 78, he's asked by the Festival Quarterly, which is a Mennonite journal, about his significance. And in 78, John Yoder replied, "Oh, time has passed me by." And he responded in that way without feeling, the reporter states. Yoder goes on, I won't strategize making sure I get my monument. Failing in his first effort to get Yoder to be introspective, the interviewer tried again by asking him if he was happy. I haven't found it very useful to ask that question, John replied. But he conceded he was thankful. So far, our children haven't hurt their parents much. I have tenure, and I don't think I'll run out of Anabaptist sources. For those of us fortunate to have known him, this exchange from Festival Quarterly is quintessential John Yoder. He viewed his own life with a godly indifference. Such indifference could be mistaken as a kind of arrogance, but it was anything but that. Yoder, born with extraordinary mental powers, had those powers shaped by a people for whom all power is a gift for service. Accordingly, Yoder never sought a career, an authorship, or even personal influence. I'm not concerned with building an empire, he told his interviewer. Powers concludes with the following words. So in a mode uncharacteristic of Yoder's way of working, I think it best to end with some of John's own words. This beautiful and exacting passage, beautiful because of its exactness, comes close to the end of the politics of Jesus. I believe that what John said in it is not only the heart of his work, but also the heart of what it means to live as a disciple of Christ. There Yoder wrote, "The key to the obedience of God's people is not their effectiveness, but their patience. The triumph of the right is assured not by the might that comes to the aid of the right, which is, of course, the justification of the use of violence and the other kinds of power in every human conflict. The triumph of the right, although it is assured, is sure because of the power of the resurrection and not because of any calculation of causes and effects, nor because of the inherently greater strength of the good guys. The relationship between the obedience of God's people and the triumph of God's cause is not a relationship of cause and effect, but one of cross and resurrection." Therefore, and that's the end of the quote from Yoder, Hauerwas concludes, "Therefore it must be true, as John put it, that the people who bear crosses are working with the grain of the universe. A life capable of producing the passage above is not replaceable, but the very God that makes such a life possible will, we can be sure, send us new and no doubt quite different John Yoders. In the meantime, we can rejoice in that grain of the universe God made present in the life of John Howard Yoder." So I hope this week will be a time in which we can both rejoice in the gift of Yoder and his life to us as one who tried to assist us in discerning the way we ought to walk, the paths that we should take. And that it can be an opportunity for us to use his words as a way of gaining continuing guidance on the paths we take. Now, specifically today, the topic is Christ against culture. And it's a concern that was close to Yoder's heart because of a very influential book, which again, some of us may be familiar with. But a book that for much of Yoder's life, he struggled with. Struggled because he thought it misrepresented the things he cared most deeply about. The book is H. Richard Niebuhr's Christ and Culture. Many of us, whenever we were in college or university or seminary, may have encountered that book. It's a classic book. Yoder thought it was classically misguided, but classic all the same. And although he thought Niebuhr was completely, he treated it with great respect despite the depth of his disagreement with Niebuhr. So that's what we're going to think about today, mainly the way Niebuhr sets up ways of understanding the Christian life and Yoder's way of dealing with neighbor. Our goal is simply this, to think a bit more carefully about the whole of the Christian life and how to construe a Christian life. Now, before going any further, though, we need to honor Yoder in one more way. One prominent theme of Yoder's thought was sort of what he referred to as the open meeting. He thought that Christianity was inherently democratic and equalitarian. And what that meant, at least in some context, is the sort of setting we have here where you have an expert or an alleged expert of some sort talking at you, that that's not the best way to go about things, that we'll make the most progress when we're some sort of community of conversation. So I'll assume, and perhaps you'll assume, that I've read a little bit more of Yoder than you have, perhaps, and that I'm fortunate enough to have the sort of vocation where I have leisure to think about these things a bit more than you do. So we'll make that assumption, but we'll also assume that you probably have richer and more interesting life experiences than I do. And that together, if we put these pieces together, then that's the context in which we'll make the most progress. So at any point, if I'm not being clear, raise questions. If you think I'm misrepresenting something, please state your objections. Admonish, correct, show signs of life, whatever. This is our session together, and so let's make of it what you'd like. Yes?
You probably mentioned this, and I walked in late, but was his background Mennonite?
Yeah, he's... And he, although the politics of Jesus is a work, might be classified as a work in Christian ethics, I mean, Yoder's hard to categorize in the sense of he was as much a historian as he was an ethicist, as he was a New Testament scholar. His work in history was on the Anabaptist tradition, the Mennonite tradition, the tradition of radical dissent and the Reformation. So that's the context which he's coming out of, quite right. Yeah. Well, okay, let's start here with step back away from Yoder for a moment. We'll step back away from Niebuhr even for a moment. But we'll start with intuitions, judgments, I suspect, we probably share. We'll test this. I suspect all of us in here, at one time or another, sometimes feel pity. That will be the generous disposition. Sometimes feel contempt. Sometimes feel outrage at certain examples of what we might identify as fundamentalist, evangelical, fundamentalist activity. I'll give you one example in which I suspect that one of those emotions or attitudes is provoked, and then perhaps you can come up with others. For examples, when we read in the paper about some Christian group prohibiting dancing, for example, or burning records of a certain sort, fairly trivial example, but that gives you the example. I mean, I suspect probably record burnings, and they do still happen, of course, that probably doesn't evoke in us outrage. Even if it's our favorite artist, it probably doesn't evoke outrage, something much more like pity. Can you think of other examples in which something like that, other cases in which we see people doing things that we think doesn't fit with being hostile to things we think Christians ought not to have that sort of hostility to? I don't know whether my one example is enough to give you the sort of thing I'm driving at, but...
Bombing an abortion clinic?
Okay, yeah, that sort of, that would be another example, opposition to something that is recognized as a legitimate thing in our culture.
Refusing to pay income taxes.
Okay, yeah, that's one I hadn't thought of, but again, yeah, that's a sort of opposition. Refusing to pay income taxes, why?
Because you're objecting to what the government is doing with the money.
Okay.
Let's say military spending.
Yeah, okay. Other examples, classic examples of censorship of some sort, protesting certain artworks or suggesting that certain literature ought not to be present and distributed in certain settings.
Jesse Helms.
Now, what is it about Jesse Helms?
Well, his, I think, I know he's on the Foreign Relations Committee, but I also think he's the one behind the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts.
Yeah, okay.
Trying to get that funding.
Yeah, yeah. In Brazil, it's because, now he might not, couch it in terms of Christianity, but in terms of common decency, that sort of thing. Though it certainly is the case that for many of his hearers, it is Christianity of some sort that's driving that agenda. Well, okay, so there's a certain set of practices which we feel outraged about. We think that the sort of hostility, the sort of way of drawing the lines of stating that the Christian way is to be against this aspect of culture in some sense, is that that's a very problematic thing. So I take it, and let's see if I'm right about this, that all of us think that there's some sense in which what we might call a Christ against culture position, saying that this is Christianity and that bit of culture, those two just can't mesh, that there are some examples of that which we think are at best problematic, and at worst perhaps even evil. We got consensus on that, fairly modest claim, but it's good to have consensus on modest claims. Okay, are you with me? Okay. But I take it at the other extreme as well, what we might call another poll, we find equally troubling examples in which we think Christianity is not being set over against some aspects of culture or some cultural practices, but that as a matter of fact, Christianity is being identified with certain practices or certain aspects of culture. And that bothers us equally. That bothers us as much as seeing Christianity set against certain practices and the like. What are some examples you can think of Christianity being wrongly, mistakenly, to your mind, identified with certain cultural or social practices?
Mm-hmm. Well, a few years ago when the Navy wanted to name a submarine Corpus Christi.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, that old, what's the name, what's the body of Christ doing on this weapon that something doesn't fit. Other examples?
I was thinking of a more general sort that a lot of conservatives, I guess, use Genesis, the part where it talks about having dominion over creation as a justification for doing with the land what we will.
Yep, okay, so a sort of identifying Christianity with the despoilation of the environment, like, yeah.
Religious right trying to put prayer in the schools because it's going to solve all our problems.
Okay. It's easy. Like, can you think of examples of I think one of the very interesting things about this is that you find many of the same people who are Christ against culture positions also being the Christ of culture position on different issues. That's a very intriguing and movement. Can you think of examples of what we might identify as the left likewise making identifications of Christianity and culture, some aspect of culture. Maybe.
Well, I was going to say it certainly works both ways. Example of not paying taxes. I mean, I think there are certain folks that we'd identify as more conservative folks out in the mountains, maybe, or have more recently done that. But I know some years ago there were clearly left-wing folks who weren't paying taxes because they were against something that the government was doing. I don't know if this would be a good example. Just in terms of welfare reform, I would say some people on the left would say to identify with that form of assistance to the poor is godly.
I think the use of the media has always been a thorny problem. Running of ads, billboards, radio time, television, I think we're more accepting, but I can remember when that was a right or a left issue, whether or not this was a thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one way, I hadn't thought about that, but one sort of interesting, yeah, certain Christian groups just automatically assuming that certain types of advertising, because it's part of the culture we live in, that's appropriate. We don't have to have reservations or questions about doing that. That raises interesting questions about, you know, church growth sorts of things, and so you could identify church certain types of evangelism and church growth movements as being, again, an affirmation of culture in a way, which might be thought to be problematic. The identification of Christianity with political parties, again, it works both ways. And again, if you're looking for people not just on the right, now maybe you think it's peculiar to think about Tipper Gore as being sort of on the left. She'd be in the center. But at least you've got Tipper Gore on the one hand who earlier is very concerned about rock music lyrics and concerned about some way of regulating that. And on the other hand, obviously a spouse of a Democratic someone high in the Democratic Party. Well, okay, so those are examples. And so the point is this, that for all of us, I think, our intuitions are that there are these two extremes that are really problematic. That if you take this posture of Christ against culture, that's just not the way Christians ought to think about our lives. Or if you take this posture in which you think Christ is to be identified with all that's good and the best of culture, that leaves out too much. If we start with those two intuitions, then we start with what H. Richard Niebuhr started out with in his book, Christ and Culture. Niebuhr's intuitions were the same. And so in Christ and Culture, what he does in the work is in first identifying briefly these two positions, and suggesting they were present in early Christianity, he develops something of a typology in which he suggests that at various stages in Christian history, there have been five different positions that Christians have taken with respect to culture. These two positions we've been talking about represent two early positions, both of which he finds problematic. And then he identifies three additional positions which he thinks are much more attractive, much more plausible, much more appealing, and presents the case for them. So what we want to do for the next few minutes is think a little bit about Niebuhr's typology, and then we'll go back to John Howard Yoder's response to that. So Niebuhr's project, first of all, the definition of the title of the book is Christ and Culture. Marx's first attempt is to define what culture is. And what Niebuhr means by culture is just the products of human creation, any type of creative human behavior. So what Niebuhr has in mind, primarily examples like the state, that's an example of culture. The economy, the family, the arts, those are the chief examples of culture, chief places where we'll find where we'll find artifacts being created of some sort. Well, Niebuhr's typology, the five positions. First of all, the Christ against culture position. In the Christ against culture position, what typically happens is that Jesus, the words of Jesus in the Gospels are read quite straightforwardly. Jesus is presented as one who makes radical demands upon his followers. And it's in light of those radical demands that Christians are led to reject aspects of culture. So, for example, 1 John 2, verse 15, do not love the world nor the things of the world. If you love the world, love for the Father. If anyone loved the world, love for the Father is not in him. That's the sort of motivating verse for the Christ against culture position. Niebuhr suggests that Tertullian is a good example of a Christ against culture position. In later history, Tolstoy, another great example of the Christ against culture position. And the Mennonite tradition. Niebuhr doesn't write much about Mennonite tradition. In fact, as Yoder admits, Niebuhr writes only one sentence about the Mennonite tradition, but it was enough to raise Yoder's ire and in response to it. Well, Niebuhr rejects the Christ against culture position. Now, if we were trying to articulate reasons for rejecting this Christ against culture position, a view that rejects the world as being an antithesis to the way of God and God's way, if we were trying to articulate specific reasons for why that can't be identified as the Christian way, what would be reasons we'd give?
Creation story.
Okay, so one objection, and this is an objection that Richard Niebuhr himself makes, is it's not sufficiently Trinitarian. That's his way of getting at your concern. He talks about a Unitarianism of the Son. Now, specifically, what Niebuhr suggests, and this is his most theological or the most complex theological objection, is that what it means to acknowledge the Trinity is to acknowledge that God as creator has a set of purposes and concerns. God as spirit is active in the church, discerning, progressing, involved in the world. And that only to emphasize the radical demands of Jesus is to forget these two other persons of the Trinity, to forget that God is creator and that God is active in the church. Now we may want to come back, as Yoder did, to that objection. But at least that's one way that Niebuhr couches his reservation about this position. Other sorts of reasons we might give for rejecting the Christ against culture position.
The church has always existed within culture. I mean, it doesn't exist outside of life.
Yeah, I think another way of putting that is you really can't consistently hold a Christ against culture position. That we're embedded in culture, we're located in culture. So one of Niebuhr's points of criticism is for any Christ against culture position, we'll be able to identify those same individuals as affirming culture at other points. They're not consistent, Niebuhr suggests. And so forget the examples of people who, the same people who burn records are often people who identify a particular political party as the party of God. They're not critical at that point. Niebuhr attacks Tolstoy. He says, look at Tolstoy living off inherited wealth at the same time that he so roundly condemns culture. So one objection Niebuhr makes is you can't consistently embrace a Christ against culture position. Any other points you would raise against the Christ against culture position? Another point Niebuhr makes is that it's just not effective. You withdraw from society. What do you accomplish? What do you accomplish by burning records? What do you accomplish, really, even by living in a community in which you eat lower on the food chain? You know, that doesn't change society, Niebuhr says. It's not an effective way of going about things. So Niebuhr identifies the Christ against culture position as not being sufficiently effective for what he takes to be progressive Christian concerns. One final objection he makes is that it locates sin in the wrong place, that sin is located in cultural structures and not in human beings, and that what needs to be dealt with is not just structures, cultural structures out there, but human beings, the human heart itself. Well, the second position, the Christ of culture position, Niebuhr also rejected. He didn't spend much time talking about that. In fact, his greatest criticism is of the Christ against culture position. He was equally dismissive of the Christ of culture, but was probably writing at a time in which he thought he didn't need to spend much time articulating what was wrong with that position. The identification in some parts with Christianity and Nazism, for example, makes it self-evident that there are problems with the identification of Christianity with culture in some sense. So Niebuhr next turns then to these three mediating positions. They're much more attractive to all of us, no doubt. The first of these is known as the Christ above culture position. Okay, so we've had Christ against culture, we've had Christ of culture, the mediating positions. Each of these mediating positions, Niebuhr suggests, takes sin more seriously in some sense. So the first is the Christ above culture position. It's a yes, but type of view. It suggests that yes, there is something good and right and appropriate about culture, but there's more to be said. The Catholic tradition, or parts of the Catholic tradition, his example is Thomas Aquinas, for example, representative of this Christ above culture position. So, for example, in Aquinas' thought, what you get is Aquinas reading Aristotle and pretty much convinced that Aristotle's way of seeing the world gets it right. It's not the whole story. We're going to have to add some more to it. But it gets the story right. We don't have to reject Aristotle. We don't have to say that Aristotle's an ungodly pagan. In fact, Aristotle gets us very far towards the truth, but not the whole truth. We're going to have to add more to it. If you were in Paul Contino's session on, it would have been Saturday, Paul talked about Dante's use of Virgil, and there it is. There's the synthesis. Virgil can take you very far down the road, not all the way, you're going to have more, but he gets it right as far as he goes. Second mediating position, Christ and culture in paradox. This is the position that's usually identified with Lutheran ethics, Lutheran social thought, Christ and culture and paradox. And it's a hard one. Well, it's a hard one for me to sort of really get my mind around. So some of you will be much better at this than I am. But the Lutheran view in trying to hold law and gospel in tension. Law is never abolished, but it's not the whole story. There's always gospel. Law is never abolished, yet it's not normative for the Christian life. The gospel, on the other hand, so in some formulations of the two kingdoms, then, the sort of way of drawing the line is to suggest that law is relevant for part of one's life, but not for one's Christian life once one has embraced Christ. The gospel is relevant for the life of the church, but not really relevant on some articulations and some way of reading Lutheran Two Kingdoms theory. Not really relevant to other parts of life. So the sort of tension between gospel and law, and trying to keep law and gospel in balance, never abandoning either one. Now, Niebuhr's response to that is, it's just too indecisive. We can't get any clear social guidance from that sort of tension, that sort of paradoxical position. The third mediating position that Niebuhr describes is Christ-transforming culture. Christ, the transformer of culture. We've had Christ against culture, we've had Christ of culture, then we get the synthesis of Christ above culture, Christ in culture in tension, or Christ in culture in paradox, and finally, Christ transforming culture. It's a position that Niebuhr spends the most amount of time on and speaks most abstractly about. Basically, Christ transforming culture starts with the position that things aren't okay the way they are, but Christ is active in the world in changing things, in bringing about a change, in transforming things from what they are to the way God desires them to be. God is active in the world, taking what's present in creation and molding it to God's purposes, whatever those purposes may be. So there's an affirmation of nature. No, you don't reject the world as it is. There's an affirmation of history. God is active in changing things, bringing them around to God's purposes. Well, okay, that's Niebuhr, the five positions. We need to turn to Yoder's response to Niebuhr, but let's make sure we're all in the same place with respect to Niebuhr. Are there questions you have, things you're not clear about that you think in a few moments we might be able to get clear about with respect to Niebuhr's five ways?
Could you put those five ways in order? I got mixed up. You did
two
extremes, a middle, and then did the other two fall kind of?
Well, so there are two extremes and three middle positions.
Okay.
And I mean, maybe if you want to visualize. Now see, the problem with your question is Niebuhr speaks in two different ways about the five positions. Sometimes Niebuhr speaks as though what we really need is all of these positions. Sort of with that diversity, with these five different positions, with all of these positions present, then we're going to have the plurality we need for a real unity. Sometimes he sounds as though he wants to affirm all five positions. But at other times, most of the time, in fact, it's clear that the transformer of culture is preferred. So if you wanted to visualize it, Christ against culture, Christ of culture, Christ above culture, Christ culture and paradox, but then the really above these two would have we would have been preferred when Christ the transformer. Anything else on Niebuhr that would be helpful at this point? Well, okay, Yoder's response. The first response Yoder makes to Niebuhr, and one that need not concern us too much here, is Yoder says Niebuhr should have been clean about his own position, or he should have been more consistent himself. That he suggests that he's really describing positions, but really he's got a normative edge. He wants the transformationist position to win. He thinks that's the best position. He should have been more candid about it. But that's not the heart of Yoder's concern. At one point in a publication, Yoder says, what's at stake in dealing with Niebuhr's typology? And he says it's important for us to wrestle with Niebuhr. But he says, really what's at stake with Niebuhr is the whether and how of Christ being Lord. That's what's at issue, the whether and how of Christ being Lord. In effect, what Yoder says to Niebuhr is that the transformationist position doesn't take seriously enough the demands of Jesus as presented in the Gospels, and insofar as we fail to take seriously the Jesus presented in the Gospels and in the New Testament, insofar as we fail to take that Jesus seriously, then we won't get authentic transformation. That to be authentically transformationist is to identify and obey the radical demands of the Jesus of the New Testament. We'll say some more about that on Wednesday in a session entitled The Possibility of a Messianic Ethic. But tonight I want to talk about some other aspects of Yoder's solution. Yoder's first additional response to Niebuhr is that Niebuhr really hasn't identified culture accurately or correctly. Or better put, Yoder says that Niebuhr makes assumptions about culture which he shouldn't have made, which undermine his entire system. Niebuhr assumes that culture is monolithic. Niebuhr assumes that culture is monolithic. That if you take an attitude towards culture in one area of life, you need to take that in every area of life. You've got to be consistent. So Niebuhr, again, as I mentioned a few moments ago, criticizes Tolstoy for not being consistent. He says you can't live off your inheritance if you're going to say that the way of Jesus is a way of poverty. You just can't do that. You got to be consistent. Yoder says, no, it's not the case that culture is monolithic. What we need to recognize is that that some parts of culture might be better, some parts of culture might be worse than other parts of culture. There's no inconsistency, in essence, Yoder starts out by saying. There's no real inconsistency in thinking there's something terribly problematic about cigarettes, but there's nothing problematic about single malt scotch. There's a way of making those two positions fit together. Niebuhr wants you to be against, if you're going to be against culture in some aspect, you better be against it in every aspect. Yoder says that's not necessary at all. Culture is much more complex than Niebuhr suggests. And Yoder goes on, the radical tradition, the Anabaptist tradition, the Mennonite tradition has recognized in a way that other Christian traditions have not recognized, in a way that certainly Niebuhr hasn't recognized, that complexity of culture. Secondly, as we said earlier, coming to grips, coming to terms with the person of who Jesus is. Niebuhr doesn't understand Jesus Well, Niebuhr's understanding of Jesus is that in Niebuhr's word, he's a radical monotheist, pointing people to a way beyond culture. Yoder suggests that doesn't take seriously the Jesus presented in the New Testament. Thirdly, Yoder responds to Niebuhr's Trinitarianism. And Yoder, so remember we, when talking about the different objections to the Christ against culture position, we did the objection of Trinitarianism. Niebuhr suggests is Trinity. There shouldn't be a Unitarianism of the Son, that God is active creating the world, the Spirit is active enlivening the church, guiding the church. Now Yoder says, in effect, what Niebuhr does is he pits the persons of the Trinity against one another. But that's not really Trinitarianism that Niebuhr is embracing. There, a genuine Trinitarianism would see the Son, that God the Creator and the Spirit all working together towards some common ends. So he suggests that Niebuhr hasn't gotten that accurately as well. Well, the Yoderian challenge then is this. If we recognize culture as complex, if we recognize some parts of culture as being more problematic than other parts of culture, the task of Christians, the task of the church, is to discern in what ways we embrace, in what ways we go against culture. Let me read some concluding words of Yoder. Instead, in each setting, each event, each relationship will open for us a set of options or challenges where we shall need to decide how to love our enemies, how to feed the hungry, how to keep our promises, how to make the earth be fruitful, how to celebrate community, how to remember our heritage. The challenge, what will you do about this value we call culture, far from helping us to be responsible, is something we're freed from by the concreteness with which the Torah and the kingdom message of Jesus describe our path. One way to clarify why concrete discernment is indispensable is to survey the culture of our time. Our world is characterized by racism, by the punitive exercise of authority from the home to the state, by genocide, pornography, the glorification of violence in commercial entertainment. These are authentically culture, but they are what an older Reformation theology called fallen. In the face of these dimensions, Niebuhr's favoring the transformation vision correlates with a low estimate of the power of evil. A high estimate of the power of evil requires being candidly and robustly against culture in at least some of its aspects and incarnations. Well, let me stop there and see where there are questions or concerns or comments, things we need to get clear about in Yoder's thought or Niebuhr's thought, ways you think it would be helpful and enriching to embellish Yoder's account as you understand it or expand upon. You get the gist then of at least Yoder's initial response to Niebuhr, that Niebuhr hasn't been genuinely Trinitarian, that Niebuhr hasn't sufficiently recognized the Jesus we meet in the Gospels and in the New Testament, and that Niebuhr finally assumes that culture is monolithic in a way that it really isn't, and that recognizing that culture is not monolithic requires of us discerning capacities which may appear from some perspectives to lead us into inconsistencies, but they'll be inconsistent only if in a very wooden way we demand a sort of perfect consistency instead of discernment. questions or comments? Yeah.
It sounds like what you said is a combination of the first two, Christ against culture and Christ above.
Yeah, well, I don't think... Well, I think Yoder would be happy with saying to be a genuine discerner means at some points you are against culture. At other points, yeah, there's going to be a yes but type of position. This is good as far as it goes. At other points, I mean, I think Yoder's response is to say, you want us to use Niebuhr's categories, and they're just not really going to be helpful in the end. Because to be a community of discernment means at different times we may find ourselves in any one of these positions with respect to different aspects of culture. And so you're quite right. Sometimes Christ against culture, sometimes Christ above culture, but also other times the paradoxical position might even make sense, the transformationist and so on. So I think your Yoder would be happy enough in some sense of saying that yeah, you're right, but we'll also be in the other positions as well. Except perhaps not the Christ off culture position. That's sort of, that's the one that I think for Yoder, recognizing the taking sin seriously is ruled out.
What would be the criticism of Yoder against our fundamentalist friends' positions on, you know, things like records or whatever, you know, they're not consistent and so forth? What would he say is wrong with that?
Well, I think probably the same things you'd say is wrong with it. What would you say is wrong with that? It's weak view of sin, a mistaken view of sin. Probably a very simplistic and somewhat silly view of particular records rather than a wider commercial enterprise in which these particular records are just some part of those sorts of responses.
But wouldn't it be just that it's a different thing you're against? That they made a wrong decision, you're against the wrong things, but you should be against other things?
Well, yeah, and I think Yoder would think it would make perfectly, I mean, maybe burning records, or see, I don't know, do CDs burn? I'm not sure. But that's probably not a, it's not a matter of whether that's an effective way of protesting. That's really not what's at issue. It's probably that, I mean, for Yoder, I'm sure there would have been any number of CDs that are worth being against. But that's not the heart of the matter. That's using a very trivial, taking something very trivial. There's something much more, much larger going on behind that, that it's also worth being against. So to take Jesus seriously is not to be against rather trivial faults of culture, but is to be able to discern what the real problems, what the real waves and sources of culture are, which go contrary to the grain of God in the universe.
In this discerning process, then, does the Christian community discern together? And each context might be different, but is the consensus a consensus that comes out of the community, or is there division in the community? Or, you know, we're two Christians, he can discern it one way and I can discern it another.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's certainly one which will have to be addressed, and we will try to address it in more detail in a session called The Royal Priesthood, which talks about the church. But just let's start with what your hunch is on that. What's your sense of how that would
work? Well, I really don't know them at all, but my...
Well, but if you were to answer the question for yourself, okay, you if you thought, well, all right, Yoder, I think Yoder's right. The church has to be a community of discernment. What we need to do is discern those ways in which culture, whatever that means, is contrary to the way of God. What would be your answer to the question of, does that mean that each individual Christian does it for himself or herself, or this community does it for itself, but a different community?
Well, if you put it that clearly, then I would say community. He would say it would be done in community.
Yeah, and you would say that.
I would too.
Okay.
But
so it wouldn't be surprising if
it's not so good.
Okay. It wouldn't be surprising if in Cambridge, Minnesota, you would have a community discerning certain needs, certain things that take priority that might be different from a community in Valparaiso, Indiana, for example. So part of what it would be to take history and nature seriously is we would be aware of where each community is located. So at least in some sense, it wouldn't be surprising to have what looked like disagreement, at least, in different communities discerning different things, setting different priorities. The more difficult question is, well, what do we make of two different communities making discernments that conflict with one another?
Are those discernments fixed? Isn't there change often? Don't the two discernments inform one another? Or even in one community where there's been a discernment at a given time, going to St. Olaf, and I was there during the first 4 years of the 60s where there was no dancing, mm-hmm. and then suddenly on the fifth year, dancing began to come in. So we have in our own tradition where we were against culture, mm-hmm. and yet that's changed with time, mm-hmm. and with, I believe, communities of Christians making discernments, informing one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, though, so all right, we can make sense of historical progression of earlier communities not seeing which later communities, who may stand on the shoulders of those earlier communities, mm-hmm. are able to see precisely because they stand on their shoulders. Right. But then there's the problem of, right, two communities, both of whom are standing on the shoulders of some earlier community, seem discerning different things. Mm-hmm. And the question is, well, what do we make of that? How do we address that? How do we make sense of that and deal with that?
And will that continue to happen? As time passes, things we now stand against probably will be welcomed in as the population demands or changes or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Now Yoder's, one of the things that troubles people about Yoder is that his view is that there are certain things that are non-negotiable and certain things the church, the wider Christian church, just has gotten wrong through the centuries. And his role is to try to persuade the wider church of those mistakes. So there's some sense in which Yoder is quite candid and quite happy and doesn't mince words about saying, if this is your discernment, then you're mistaken. It doesn't fit. So there's a norm, there's a source there. And for Yoder, that norm and that source is the Gospels, the New Testament, the story of Jesus that we get in Christian scriptures.
Can you give an example of what you would consider
the use of violence? If you think violence is justifiable, if you discern in a situation that the way of God is the way of violence. You're not seeing things the right way.
So he would never argue for a just war or self-defense?
I mean, what's very interesting about Yoder, and these are on the tapes, actually, in the library. He discusses this. What he has done, instead of sort of denouncing just war tradition, I mean, he's a radical pacifist, but what he's done in a number of publications, and he does in the series of these tapes, is he suggests, all right, let's really, if you folks who embrace the just war tradition, I'm going to take you seriously. And what I'm going to do then is I'm going to go over the aspects, the specific criteria you identify and discuss, and we're going to see what it would look like to take them seriously. So I'm going to make you at least have the integrity of your position, even though he thinks it's a mistaken position. So I mean, it's very interesting in that respect. But that would be an example in which those who discern different things differently are mistaken about it.
Even defending your own shores against direct attack in response to a violence against oneself.
We were discussing earlier one of Yoder's earlier books, which actually started with a very long article called "What Would You Do If?" which presents the example of, well, all right, it's the case of someone dependent upon oneself being under attack, which is sort of, for most of us, the prime example. Here is an innocent person being attacked. Surely many of us think under those circumstances it would be appropriate to respond with, if necessary, to protect the innocent with some sort of violent activity. But Yoder examines that very carefully, and his argument is no, that in fact to respond in that way is indicative of a lack of trust in God, in effect.
But he doesn't go into Revelation, does he?
Face the war, I'm not sure.
The prediction of wars and all of that in Revelation.
Yeah, well, I think his response, he does talk in the politics of Jesus about God as warrior and point the Old Testament stories of God as warrior and discusses those aspects. He also, in the politics of Jesus, the concluding chapter is the sacrifice of the Lamb, which is drawn from a text in the book of Revelation. So he does indeed deal with those passages which look like they might warrant some sort of Christian tolerance of the use of violence, and in fact suggests that a more careful, appropriate way of reading them is that that's not the way of God. That recognizing the fallenness of the world, we're not surprised that wars continue and so on, but that's a much different matter from embracing the way of Christ. We need to bring things to a close. One last comment, or
how does he treat expediency? Would he say that was a root of inconsistency, that it doesn't exist?
Well, he says, I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but one common thread of his argument is that effectiveness is not the calling of Christians. Expediency is not the calling of Christians. To be faithful is the Christian calling. Thank you very much.
Thank you.